From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razazan. This week, we speak with two UC Berkeley students about the McCarthyite backlash against pro-Palestinian speech and activities at UC Berkeley and other campuses in the U.S.
The Zionists are defaulting into narratives about anti-Semitism when time and time again, it has been proven that most students on campus, all actions are never anti-Semitic, but are very adamantly, clearly anti-Zionist. And any attempts to conflate both is purely and deliberately an attempt to silence.
As a law student, as an advocate, I really hope that we can continue to maintain an environment where those who want to speak out against Israel can speak out, and where those who want to learn about Israel and Palestine can actually do so without the fear of repercussions.
Students say they have been doxxed online and have been told not to use their names for fear of reprisal from future employers. Later in the program, we discuss the powerful new documentary, White Torture, by jailed Iranian political prisoner Narges Mohammadi. She was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in October for her fight against the oppression of women in Iran. We also talk about an upcoming stage reading of Woman, Life, Freedom, which focuses on last year's historic uprising in Iran. Stay with us. In the wake of the massacre of October 7th and the genocidal onslaught that has followed, students advocating for peace and justice in Palestine have come under unprecedented attack on campuses across the country, with professors and university administrators overtly doxing and blacklisting their own students against norms of free speech and First Amendment protections, recalling the darkest hour of a McCarthy era in the 1950s when entire groups of people were jailed, ostracized, and in some cases even executed by the state simply for following their conscience and voicing their opinion. Today, we speak with two UC students who have spearheaded the push for justice in Palestine at UC Berkeley and who have refused to be silenced by a brutal campaign of terror and intimidation right here at home on U.S. campuses. For the sake of protecting their identities, in the following interviews, we only use their first names. They spoke with Khalil Bendib.
On October 11th, 4 days after the Hamas attack, you collectively published a statement of solidarity with Gaza. Let me start with you, Benan. What brought you to the Palestine cause? So as a graduate student,
yes,
you're still taking chances. You're still putting yourself on the line. What brings you to the Palestinian cause?
I am Arab and I am Muslim. Of course, for me, it's a core part of how I grew up. It's a core part of my identity, of my upbringing, of understanding that the Palestinian cause is at the core any justice movement or any kind of alignment towards this hoping for liberation. But for me, Palestine also speaks to the moments that we're in now. It speaks to how our systems are very intricate. As an American, as someone who was born and raised in the US, I am very much implicated in what is happening in Palestine. And so it is my duty, regardless of risk, to stand up to power and puncture power and call out the evil that we are seeing that's happening to Palestine.
How about you, John? Bluntly, I'd like to ask you, are you, as some people might, are you an anti-Semite for being involved in a cause like this? I mean, people are trying to equate anti-Zionism, anti-Semitism.
It's a question that I think the most honest response to is to genuinely laugh. No one in my group nor myself has ever made a statement that is anti-Semitic in its intention or its effect. We're not talking about Judaism as a religion. We are not talking about Jewish people as a people. We are talking about the actions of a state that coats itself in an ethno-nationalist identity, Israel. We're calling for a ceasefire. If calling for a ceasefire is an anti-Semitic action, I think that's a gross misuse of the term anti-Semitism. And it's the thing that we've been trying to separate since before October 7th and throughout the entirety of this conflict. To be anti-Zionist, to be critical of the state of Israel, is not to be anti-Semitic. And that is a rhetorical strategy that has been used by Zionists to great effect. And it's a bit saddening that in the midst of all this, the first thing we have to address is whether or not criticizing Israel is anti-Semitic. It's not.
Yeah, the reason I ask you is that Stephen Davidoff Solomon, mm-hmm. a professor at Berkeley yeah. Law, in a now infamous Wall Street Journal op-ed piece, writes, quote, "For too long, this type of attitude has been going on in college campuses where you can just substitute Zionist for Jews, and you can spout hatred because it's about Jews and Israel," end of quote. Why are people in positions of power like Professor Davidoff Solomon and others insist on that? You just started answering that question. I'm conflating anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. Is it a way to prevent dialogue from happening, or simply an attempt to delegitimize any criticism of Israel? Either one of you, please jump in.
I'd love to respond to that. Like, I think it's both. And it's a very useful strategy for those who don't have a clear understanding of what Israel is, of its history and its and the creation. The originating documents of Zionism were very explicit about what it was. You know, it was a colonial venture. And it was only after the happenings in World War II that really this rhetorical strategy of conflating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism really took hold. And I'd be remiss if I didn't note as well that, you know, there are multiple organizations of Jewish students and Jewish advocates who are completely ignored in this discussion when they speak out against the state of Israel. I mean, even before October 7th, there were major uprisings within the state of Israel itself criticizing the Netanyahu government for its actions. And those things are swept under the rug via this rhetorical strategy of calling anyone who's critical an anti-Semite. That's not the case. And I think Professor Solomon should know better than to make such a ridiculous conflation. As a lawyer, you know, you're taught to be precise with your words. And there's, I think, something very disingenuous about what he's doing there. And so it's very disappointing.
Sigmund Freud, the father of psychoanalysis, I think would see a case of what he called projection and the Zionist rhetoric equating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. Is that in that it's the hatred Zionists feel towards anti-Zionists that is the hatred they claim to be subjected to. In other words, instead of fessing up to their own hatred of anyone who criticizes Israel, they claim that it is those who criticize Israel who are filled with hatred, and specifically a hatred of Jews and not of Israeli apartheid. And therefore, you would be the problem, not they. They make the claim that it's impossible to hate the sin without hating the sinner. You must hate me, and the only possible reason you do that is that I'm a Jew. Being Jewish, under this logic, should absolve Israel of all its crimes. And therefore, there's no possible legitimate criticizing of settler colonialism and Zionism. It's a typical tactic of inversion. Bad faith people, many Zionists who claim that it's the same, anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, it's a way to blame the victim, as usual. In his infamous op-ed, again, that I just mentioned, published in the Wall Street Journal, the op-ed is titled, "Don't Hire My Anti-Semitic Law Students." Honest to God, this is the title of his op-ed. Davidoff Solomon overtly advocates blacklisting his own students to deprive them from any future living as a lawyer. What has been the law school's dean reaction to this? Banan, can you address this question?
Sure. I will say, though, as I am not a law student, just as someone who has been following it on the outside and seeing the ostracization and categorization of my friends who are organizing for Palestine and labeling them as anti-Semites, he has stepped out from his role as an administrator and has taken very biased stances, revoking the membership, the academic credits for journals who adopted the BDS bylaw. He has explicitly connected those who stand up for anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism in his latest article in the LA Times. And so he, as someone who is supposed to stand for all students, and before, when they were being targeted by doxing trucks, he had said that they had the right to say that they are anti-Zionists. Now he has taken a completely different shift and is targeting the groups that are standing up for Palestine and is taking away academic accreditation, is labeling them as anti-Zionists in a larger university context that has been really watering down its language towards attacks towards students who are pro-Palestinian. Just a few weeks ago, we had protesters who came onto campus who attacked Muslim students, calling them ISIS, who pushed pro-Palestinian students and calling them rapists. And this happened in front of a police officer, and the university really never took a stance, but took a very hardline stance when they said that there were students who may have said things that were just pro-terrorism, as in they objected to the violence in Gaza. So the dean of the law school is really reflecting larger trends within the university of targeting students who are pro-Palestinian, of watering down the threats that they faced, and really equating the violence that pro-Palestinian students are facing with like language or subtle language that they feel that students who are pro-Israel might be feeling, although they have no concrete evidence in the same way that we have been able to present. We have been called ISIS, we have been called terrorists, we have been called rapists.
Yeah, and if I could jump in here as well to just speak directly to what the law school reaction to this has been. Stepping back a year, in response to the bylaw that our group had tried to pass, barring Zionist speakers, there was a whole slew of doxing that followed, and many students were named and doxed individually. And the dean had met with us repeatedly over this issue to address it. He was genuinely invested in protecting his students, as is his role as the dean. And he had put out a statement condemning any retaliatory measures against students for their rightful political speech in support of Palestine. That statement is not being honored with respect to the latest controversy regarding Professor Solomon. The dean explicitly condemned that sort of behavior just a year past, and now that it is no longer administratively convenient for him to stick to that position, he is reneged. And he's followed that up with, you know, a whole slew of equivocations. And the central one, and it gets to Banan's point as well, is that any speech now that is critical of Israel can be denounced as hate speech, because to be critical of Israel, according to their rhetoric, is to be anti-Semitic. And this doesn't hold up to scrutiny. And anyone with a reasonable amount of awareness regarding this issue knows that it's at this critical moment that people need to speak out against Israel. And it's also going to be at this critical moment that tool is going to be used against us in full force. And so it's just very sad to see that the dean now can't hold his position, and that many people who would have taken a more nuanced position on all of this are suddenly reverting back to the classic rhetoric of Islamophobia and just wholesale condemnation of anyone who isn't pro-Israel. Yeah, it's very disheartening.
To really drive that point home, we have the UC faculty wrote, the Zionist faculty wrote a letter that really, really built up on every single Islamophobic, anti-Arab, anti-Palestinian trope. And it was signed by Carol Christ herself, our chancellor, Carol Christ, in her personal capacity. And this is the person who is supposed to be, this is the person that whose task is to ensure that students feel that they can speak their opinion, that they can do, that they are free to take the really important stances that they feel that they can take. But she took a very obvious stance by signing this letter, which truly is a grotesque letter of Islamophobic and anti-Palestinian tropes. And that just speaks, not only is it at the dean's level, but it's at the chancellor herself. It's at every single strata of UC administration. We're seeing people come out and really building off of these Islamophobic tropes.
So what do you guys see as the cause for this change of hearts, that under pressure after October 7th, all of a sudden, these guys are folding, caving? What's happened that changed their minds? Is it donors who are putting pressure? What is it that may have turned them?
I think it's this new wave of McCarthyism that's taken over, that is really either showing people in their true colors, or is creating an atmosphere of fear in which one has to really take on anti-Palestinian stances to simply survive.
Yeah,
I'm not so kind to think that is it's the latter, and I do think it is people giving into this wave of McCarthyism, because at the end of the day, we do see that there is a genocide happening. there is violence happening, and this is the moment in which people must be called to action and people must take moral stances, and they have failed us and they have failed themselves, first of all. And so I do think it's this atmosphere of McCarthyism alongside people maybe showing their true colors.
Yep.
You've both mentioned the term doxing. Can one of you explain what that means?
Yeah, I'd be happy to explain that. So doxing is the practice of taking or making public someone's personal information and encouraging others to harass or intimidate them because they've taken a political stance that you disagree with. It's happened on our campus repeatedly, primarily to pro-Palestinian students. There was the infamous example of a truck driving around campus broadcasting to the public students' names, who were organizers or leaders of organizations on campus that had adopted a bylaw refusing to admit Zionist speakers to campus. That kind of behavior is intended to silence. The intention of doxing is to punish people for taking a position that you disagree with publicly. And it tends to work very, very well. Students are very, very afraid. I'm on this radio show anonymously because I know that if I publicize my name, someone will try to personally harm me for that. Whether that's, you know, ruining your chance at a career or much, much worse.
In a letter written in support of Students for Justice in Palestine, Jewish Berkeley Law alumni state that, quote, deliberately equating anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism and causing deep discomfort for pro-Palestinian and anti-Zionist Jewish students is happening, and we oppose the implication that somehow Palestinian freedom threatens Jewish safety, end of quote. What do you make of this claim by many pro-Israel students and now teachers, that they don't feel safe when people like you are free to criticize Israel? And given the heightened anti-Semitism brought about by Donald Trump and his ilk over the past 6 years, do you think that some of these fears, however misguided, might be sincere? Or is this just one more attempt to silence voices advocating for justice in Palestine?
I think it is an attempt to silence criticisms for the actions of the state of Israel, the ethno-national state of Israel. We have seen, for example, in Stanford a few days ago, there was chalk on the sidewalk that was written, "Come here to chant to kill Jewish babies." And it went viral to show that this proves that, yes, these students are anti-Semitic. And when Stanford did their investigation, it turned out that a Zionist student wrote that so that it can go viral and so that the students can be labeled as anti-Semitic. And so I think that this moment really speaks to people are waking up and seeing the violence of Zionism. And the Zionists are defaulting into narratives about anti-Semitism when time and time again, it has been proven that most students on campus, all actions are never anti-Semitic, but are very adamantly, clearly anti-Zionist. And any attempts to conflate both is purely and deliberately an attempt to silence.
I think that something worth considering here is that, you know, the anxiety that some Zionist individuals feel in this moment, you know, it has a very real historical analog throughout almost every struggle and resistance that we've seen in history. You don't even have to go that far. Like in 2020, when Black Lives Matter was at the peak of its advocative moment, there was a lot of anxiety among American whites, you know, the feeling that like there is some groundswell of frustration that is kicking in here and being actualized. I think I have some sympathy for those who don't know how to react to that when you have to acknowledge that systemically you're a beneficiary of some kind of harmful system. That's a scary thing to recognize. And while that is a valid concern and something that should be talked about civilly, it's not a basis for silencing the action. I'm reminded of people who wanted to say that Black Lives Matter made them feel like their lives didn't matter, and so that they resorted to the rhetoric of all lives matter, which is a nothing kind of rhetoric at the end of the day. Obviously, in colonial struggles, this dynamic is tenfold. But the point is, for those who feel that calling for the freedom of Palestinians is a threat to their safety, you really need to interrogate that position. You need to like scrutinize why you don't feel safe that somebody else is asking for their freedom. That is a racist position and very problematic.
And as you were,
but actually.
And as you were saying, there's definite backlash in this country as we speak against the very notion of teaching our history to students, including white students, what happened under slavery, genocide of the Indians here. It makes them uncomfortable. It makes them scared. If that's a valid opposition to the idea of making progress and teaching people what actually happened in our history, then yes, it will make people very uncomfortable. Governor DeSantis is on a tear in Florida to make illegal any teaching of the history of slavery. Just to reaffirm what you were saying, John.
If I could add one more thing too, it also explains why a lot of the most intense, you know, flashpoints in these kind of discursive struggles are on campuses. Because sometimes what I hear in call to not criticize the state is there's people fighting for their ignorance, like pushing to block out anything that might trouble their sense of security in the world that's been crafted around them. As academics, it's really our responsibility to resist that. And as an administration, it's really their responsibility to ensure that that can happen, you know, that ignorance can't be actively created, that, you know, people can't be insulated in their ignorance on campus. Like, you need to know what's going on if you want to call yourself, you know, a genuine academic. And I think people are waking up to that. And that's very anxiety inducing for those who don't want that.
In the face of such fierce and illegal McCarthyist tactics, exposing your own students to the wrath of potential employers, is there a possibility of class lawsuits, or would that backfire by exposing the real identities of students who have a conscience, who are trying to advocate for peace? Are there lawyers out there willing to take this sort of case, which to me seems pretty obvious, pretty self-evident, on a pro bono basis? Are you guys getting any support from lawyers out there who would sue these people doing these illegal things against their own students?
Yes, there are actually several class actions in the process, and a lot of legal aid societies have stepped up and asked us how they can help. I know that there is one that is in the works for students who have been targeted or who haven't been supported by universities for Islamophobic attacks. There is another one for the law students, I believe. There are lawyers who are stepping up and who are noticing that what is happening is must truly be addressed immediately so that it does not lead to structural and systemic targeting of groups, especially since, like you said, in Florida, while they banned the history of teaching of history of the slavery, they're also trying to ban Students for Justice in Palestine, the justice organizations that are student-led that really lead most of the Palestine actions on campuses across the nation. Florida is trying to lead its delegitimization. And so lawyers are stepping up and are really working towards supporting students.
Well, that's good to hear. I mean, the point of studying the law in this country is that there's supposed to be a law and it's supposed to be implemented. So it's good to hear that there are lawyers out there who worry about these blatant attempts against our justice system. Anything you'd like to say in conclusion?
All I'd like to say is that as a law student, as an advocate, I really hope that we can continue to maintain an environment where those who want to speak out against Israel can speak out, and where those who want to learn about Israel and Palestine can actually do so without the fear of repercussions. We're working tirelessly towards that. And
to add that Graduate Students for Justice in Palestine came together after this current genocide, and the amount of students who are hungry to support Palestine, who are hungry to speak out against the violence that they see, is astounding and is very grounding and is very heartwarming and really speaks to the moment that we are in, that this is not another siege on Gaza that we will think back to. This is a moment that's pivotal and that's going to change the course, hopefully, of how Palestine is addressed and how we can have systemic change to Palestine and how we can find ways to have our demands being met. And again, in a free Palestine one day.
Banan is a graduate student and a member of Graduate Students for Justice in Palestine, John, a pseudonym, is a law student and a member of Berkeley Law Students for Justice for Palestine. They spoke with Khalil Bendib from Pacifica Radio. This is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. On Monday, Iranian political prisoner and one of Iran's foremost human rights activists, Narges Mohammadi, started a hunger strike in protest over being blocked, along with other inmates, from getting medical care. In October, she was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for her fight against the oppression of women in Iran and her fight to promote human rights and freedom for all. Here is the head of the Nobel Committee, Breitreich Anchen, speaking about Narges Mohammadi.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2023 to Narges Mohammadi for her fight against the oppression of women in Iran and her fight to promote human rights and freedom for all. Her brave struggle has come with tremendous personal cost. Altogether, the regime has arrested her 13 times, convicted her 5 times, and sentenced her to a total of 31 years in prison and 154 lashes. Ms. Mohammadi is still in prison as I speak. 2 years later, after her release on bail, Ms. Mohammadi immersed herself in a campaign against the use of death penalty. Iran has long been among the countries that execute the highest proportion of their inhabitants annually. Just since January 2022, more than 860 prisoners have been punished by death in Iran. Her activism against the death penalty led to the rearrest of Ms. Mohammadi in 2015 and to a sentence of additional years behind walls. Upon her return to prison, she began opposing the regime's systematic use of torture and sexualized violence against political prisoners, and especially women, that is practiced in Iranian prisons. Narges Mohammadi is a woman, a human rights advocate, and a freedom fighter. In awarding her this year's Nobel Peace Prize, the Norwegian Nobel Committee wishes to honor her courageous fight for human rights, freedom, and democracy in Iran. This year's Peace Prize also recognizes the hundreds of thousands of people who in the preceding year have demonstrated against the theocratic regime's policies of discrimination and oppression targeting women.
Narges Mohammadi is serving multiple sentences in Tehran's notorious Evin prison, amounting to 12 years imprisonment, one of the many periods she has been detained behind bars. Charges against her include spreading propaganda against the state. In a letter smuggled out of prison and read by her daughter, Kiana, in a video posted on the Nobel website, Mohammadi said the news of her Nobel Prize had been met with cries from her cellmates of, quote, woman, life, freedom, the slogan of the movement of which she is part of. She has also edited the powerful documentary White Torture, based on her book by the same name. The documentary sheds light on the harrowing treatment of political prisoners in solitary confinement in Iran. White Torture was created during a brief period when she was released from prison. Through interviews with a variety of former inmates, we meet individuals subjected to torture by being in isolation. White Torture refers to a form of psychological torture using isolation and sensory deprivation through solitary confinement, widely practiced in Iranian prisons. White Torture won an award at the International Film Festival and Human Rights Forum in 2022, and it will have its debut in the Bay Area on Sunday, November 12th at 1 p.m. at Roxy Cinema in San Francisco. I spoke with Ali, a UC student, about the book and the documentary.
The documentary, White Torture, is based on a book of the same name, which was released in 2021, where Ms. Narges Mohammadi interviewed and compiled all the interviews from 14 other inmates of Iran's notorious Evin prison, where these methods of white torture, as she describes it, I'll actually just quote her, and she describes sensory deprivation. It deprives prisoners of any kind of sensory stimulation over long periods of time. This is used along with solitary confinement and interrogation. People are often incarcerated without going to trial. This means that there is no impartial body to appeal their sentence to. They are unsure of their actual sentence and how long their incarceration will last. And there are multiple accounts from multiple of the women who were interviewed throughout the book talking about how they never knew their rights. Their family members were never informed about the status of their trials or anything of the sort. And she tries to bring these to light because another key aspect of Evin is that there's not a lot of information that's allowed to get out. And even the fact that Ms. Mohammadi has been able to put out statements to the outside world is an incredibly brave feat on its own, and really something that has led to her being seen as one of the most important activists of this generation. All this has culminated to her having won the Nobel Peace Prize this last year, something that only, I believe it was 18 other women have won since the award's inception over 100 years ago. So she joins very elite company, along with the likes of Shirin Ebadi, who won the award about 2 decades ago. But this, I think, award shows that not only is this an issue that is relevant to Iranian social justice pertaining to the Iranian diaspora and people inside Iran, but also that it's a situation that I think touches on a lot of global issues of social justice, of prison reform, abolition, things of this nature, where the methods that Ms. Mohammadi describes in the book and that she demonstrates in the film are things that originate, that one can find origins to in the United States prison system. So for anyone who is trying to understand not just the methods of torture that Iranians are facing, people who are also trying to see how these systems are global and international, I think would benefit significantly from seeing a film like this, reading a book like the one that won Ms. Mohammadi the Nobel Peace Prize, and being exposed to these methods of torture that, as Ms. Mohammadi describes, rely on sensory deprivation.
I just want to mention a couple of cases. One is Hengame Shahidi. She was given almost 13 years for complaining publicly about judicial corruption. After being released, she has been under medical treatment as a result of being in solitary confinement, and she has never been able to resume her life. Another prisoner that Nargis interviewed is Marzia Amiri. She's an Iranian journalist in prison for trying to find out what had happened to a group of protesters. And she said, "I was returned to solitary confinement. At that moment, I saw myself as mad, and I experienced a fear that was not the fear of the interrogator and the prison. I feared myself. Your bedlock is the principle of social life, and the solitary cell takes it all away from you." What else can you tell us about what's in this book and what people should expect to see in the documentary?
I think that the example that you just read off is very good. And if I can say one more example from someone else that was interviewed in the book, Nazanin Zoghari Radcliffe, The account in the book describes that the atmosphere in the cell was scary. I could not bear to look around. There was a steel rod welded into the floor 10 centimeters from the wall, which bothered me. I didn't know what it was until the prisoners they brought into the cell said that it was used to punish prisoners who were soon to be executed. They tied them to the rod. It was terrifying. I was very petrified. I thought about the many people who had spent their last night here and who had been tied to this bar. I felt like I could hear their voices. There was nothing in the cell but a toilet, a bucket, 2 blankets, a Quran, and a copy of the book, Mofatih al-Jinan. And I think there are a lot of stories like this in the documentary as well. Now, frankly, this documentary is yet to be shown in the United States, which is why I think this event on the 12th of November will be so significant for people here in the Bay Area. But despite that, I think that the way that it's been received globally has shown that these stories really do speak to audiences of Iranians and non-Iranians alike, who are advocates of social justice and who want to ensure that at the very least, these kinds of systems can gain some kind of recognition on a global scale rather than being dismissed as some kind of one-off institutions, because the systems of Evin prison are systems that can be found in a lot of other prison systems throughout the world.
Yeah, and for people who are not familiar with Nazanin, she's a British Iranian who spent 6 years in jail in Iran. And she was arrested in 2016, separated from her daughter as she was about to board a flight home from Iran. And she was in Tehran visiting her parents, and she was accused of spying by Iranian authority, an accusation, of course, that she has denied. And she was released last March. She's one of the people featured in this documentary.
Yes, and I think that also maybe touches on another important aspect of the Iranian prison system known as Moharebeh, which is this idea of waging war against God. And I think finds a lot of people like Ms. Mohammadi, like Ms. Nazanin, in prison and in these systems of torture, when in reality, their war against God, as it is called, is truly just a war against, not even a war, it's any opposition to the regime, which views itself as some kind of a divine figure.
So Ali, before we end, can you tell us where and when this film is going to be screened, White Torture?
On the 12th of November, on Sunday at 1 p.m. at the Roxy in San Francisco. If you just Google the Roxy Theater San Francisco or Roxy White Torture, you'll be taken to their website where they've published a page with some information as well as some information about Ms. Mohammadi's current state, including her hunger strike that she has recently undergone as a result of her poor health conditions. 12th of November, Sunday, 1 p.m. at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco is where this film can be screened for the first time in the United States.
White Torture will be screened on Sunday, November 12th at 1 p.m. at Roxy Cinema in San Francisco. It won an award at the International Film Festival and Human Rights Forum in 2022. For more information and ticket reservation, please visit roxy.com. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. On November 10th and 11th, members of Iranian community will come together for a stage reading of Woman, Life, Freedom, Resistance, and Revolution. The 90-minute drama centers around the historic Woman, Life, Freedom uprising in Iran following the killing of a 22-year-old Kurdish-Iranian woman, Mahsa Jina Amini. The devised drama uses reportage from international news services and social media with photographs, videos, and recorded and live music. Ensemble members share first-person accounts of harassment, imprisonment, and the execution of friends and family members. The drama also highlights the humanity, simplicity, and humor of the Iranian people, women and men, young and old, who are trying their best to figure out their lives under the Islamic regime. I spoke with Dr. Jalil Niazi, a pediatrician, community activist, and one of the organizers of the event.
Actually, our neighbor, we're lucky to have a famed director and social work theater owner who actually operates out of Nepal, but is a Fulbright scholar, Deborah Marola, be our neighbor. And at one of these dinner parties, she has Iranian friends, and we were having a conversation. It became a very heated discussion, but she got up the idea from there and approached us to write a play, or actually initially she wanted to use a particular article and adapt it for a play. But as she spoke with the Iranian community and we got more and more of the Iranian Americans involved, it evolved into a much deeper play, which has really taken over all of our lives for the past 4 months. Mm-hmm. We were already kind of committed to Woman, Life, Freedom as Iranian Americans for more than a year. But I think Deborah became completely committed in the past 4 months, really overshadowing everything else that she has to do in her life. So we really appreciate that this amazing, gifted artist is helping us out with this.
So this is a stage reading.
Yes.
And it's going to happen on November 10th and 11th. Give us a thumbnail of what this stage reading is all about.
It has four acts in it. The first one mainly talks about the Woman, Life, Freedom revolution, and she has adapted it into various scenes about Mahsa dying. Mahsa Jina Amini, who you know more than a year ago on September 16th, was murdered by the morality police in Iran. And subsequent to that, huge demonstrations have happened around Iran, which have faced violent suppression by the government. And so this has been ongoing for us Iranian Americans we've been involved in that. So that the first act kind of is a dramatization of various scenes, basically coming again, what is the source from various different places? For example, the Frontline documentary, there's scenes from that, from articles in New York Times, from the New Yorker, from various social media inputs, and from the Iranian Americans here. So that's the first act. The second act, actually, she wanted to have the lived histories of some of the Iranian Americans here who have suffered through the various suppressions in the past 44 years and their personal history. So she was very committed to that. And she's done that with her other work in South Africa and Argentina and various other things. So we have some really first time stories being told by the people who experienced it. And then the third act has some kind of lighter stuff, still sceneries based on an article. I believe it's in the New York Times, but one of these journal articles. And so she's dramatized those. And then the fourth scene, which is the final act, brings us up to date to where we are now. She touches upon a few Iranian women and wraps it up with what to look forward to.
This devised drama uses reportage from international news services and social media with photographs, videos. So I assume it was very, very difficult deciding what to include in this stage reading. So what was that process like?
Yes, very difficult. And if you can imagine, very emotional, because we are talking about sometimes, especially with that act two, personal narratives of siblings being murdered by this terrible regime, or just even retelling of the story of the atrocities that are happening now. We have some prison scenes that also are personal histories of people watching executions. What it started, it's kind of people kept on telling stories. And you can imagine, Maliha, you know this, in the Iranian American diaspora and like opposition, there isn't complete uniformity. There are many, many different perspectives. So it is a very valid question. At the end, we emphasize, or Deborah is the director, so she is kind of making those choices. And it's nice to have that she's kind of a little bit further away from us being completely submerged in this history for the past 44 years or longer. And so she tried to make it more dramatic. If it was completely wrong, like if we thought it was offensive, she was open to our ideas that this shouldn't be included. If it was unbalanced. And I think she's open to actors changing it if they don't feel like it's the right thing to say as we're even doing the rehearsals and the stage readings. She is very, very sensitive to what we're going through, because for some of us, it's the first time that they're telling this story ever to others. So you can imagine how emotionally kind of exhausting it could have been. But we are so committed to this cause, to this woman life freedom movement, or revolution, I should call it, which is really the first woman-led revolution, grassroots from any part of the world during our lifetime. And it's inclusive and it's nonviolent. And it should be a template for the rest of the world to use the feminine energy to problem solve, to coexist, to cooperate, as opposed to death, destruction, and kind of ownership.
This play concludes with a call to action.
We are going to have an advocacy table there. There are many things that can happen. One important one is to writing to your senator. There is a MASA Act in Congress, which has passed the House, surprisingly, in this divided Congress, 410-3, which condemns the leadership of the Iranian regime, Khamenei, Raisi, and whoever else who has been involved in these crimes against humanity, calling it out and sanctioning them. So freezing their assets. So we would like people to be galvanized to contact senators and pass this, the SR 2626, the MASA Act, in the Senate and have President Biden sign it. Other things are activities that we have done that people can join. For example, Dina is going to join us with her quilt, and her quilt which is similar to the AIDS quilt, has been gaining momentum. And I actually contributed a little piece of it for Woman Life Freedom. It was showcased at Golden Gate Park, I don't know, several months ago. And I was very impressed with how many she had. It's just amazing work of art and how beautiful people had contributed. But since then, it's grown a lot more. And she uses that quilt to start the conversation about women-led movements around the world.
Some of the panels she has received have come from Iran.
Yeah. So very impressive. That is another. There is a bridge of unity that people are involved with. You may have seen it over I-80, where people are holding, you know, Woman Life Freedom and wanting to and getting honks. And that has gone around to other bridges. So those bridges of unity are showing that people are unified all around the different places that they're going to. And that's another activity that people can get involved with. For me, for example, another thing is a UC Chancellor, Chris, has not signed on or condemned the Iranian government for what it's done to the students or the professors or what it's general. Other universities, for example, Georgetown made a statement early on, but UC Chancellor is refusing to do that. And I believe they're still working with the Iranian government. So that's something that we can do to write and call and hold her accountable for what she's doing there. Myself also have reached out to the American Academy of Pediatrics because I am a pediatrician and asked them to condemn the Iranian government for all the kids that are being killed. At least 75 have been killed, and not only killed, but tortured. We all know about Niko Shakarami. People, without exaggeration, they said almost every bone in her body was broken after she disappeared from a rally. And you know this story better. 10 days later is given to the family and is asked not to even be buried in where they wanted to, and they had to do something remote. And that she is just one of the many children, because this Woman Life Freedom movement is a youth movement. It's a woman-led movement. It's a young movement. And so the children and the young adults are the ones who are in the biggest numbers being attacked and tortured and raped and blinded. As you know, pellets are being directed directly at eyes, and more than 500 people have lost their vision. More than 600 have died. And the executions we know that are linked to it are about 7, but it's a lot more. 7 officially, but hundreds, because Iran remains one of the top countries that performs executions. And the courts continue to be sham courts. There's not really any due process. And so if they want to suppress any oppression, they come up with something and they will execute the person. All of this is something that I asked the American Academy of Pediatrics for them to condemn that, but they still aren't doing it. They have said, we don't have a policy for it. So that's something, for example, I can try to do. So there are many, many things that one can do. We're all kind of exhausted from these complete injustice and the death and the, you know, genocide that goes on. And our emphasis, our focus with the earth being destroyed by all these old ways of thinking, we have to kind of turn it around and change the emphasis and get the power back to focus more on life and cooperation and coexistence, but hold the people who are committing these atrocities accountable. It's not like business as usual.
To conclude, how can people find out more about this event, this stage reading?
We have various flyers up around the different areas. A direct contact email for us is wlf.berkeley@gmail.com. You can kind of reach out to us and tell us which night you want to come for us to reserve seats for you. There is a $20 suggested donation per person, but it's a donation, so people can come for free. It's mainly to educate the public about what's going on. And it's two nights. It's November 10th and November 11th at the Epworth's Church.
It's from 7 to 8:30 p.m. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. and it's at Epworth United Methodist Church, 1953 Hopkins Street in Berkeley.
If you are on Instagram or on Facebook, I am open to the public. I have, so it's Jale Niazi. It's not hard to find me. Jalehniazi. I've posted the flyer on there as well. There is a QR code that you can use, which will take you to a questionnaire and telling us how many people want to come. The space is limited. We're not planning to do it again. And so this might be the only time that you will see this play.
The stage reading of Woman, Life, Freedom, Resistance, and Revolution will take place on Friday, November 10th and Saturday, November 11th at 7 p.m. at Epworth United Methodist Church, located at 1953 Hopkins Street in Berkeley. For more information, please visit wlf.berkeley@gmail.com. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
And that's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
You can find us on Twitter at @Vomina_radio or listen to our past shows on iTunes or SoundCloud at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. You can also reach us by email at vominaradio@gmail.com. Please join us next week for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, and thank you for listening.